Okay, welcome to episode 380 of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. My name is Divine, and in today's podcast, we'll be continuing the rapid review series for the USMLE Step 2 CK / Step 3 exams. This is going to be Series 72. So, if you're taking your USMLE Step 2 CK or Step 3, or Complex Level 2 or 3 exams, within the next 1 month, I will encourage you to sign up for the courses I have next week. I start off with an MBME Test Taking Strategies course on Monday. And then I continue that with a 24-hour review course from Tuesday to Friday. We'll meet for 6 hours each day. There's many people that have taken these courses that have done extremely well on the exams. I see people, they take the Test Taking Strategies course and they say that, wow, my QBank percentages shot up after I took the course, or wow, my practice test scores improved by 20, 30, 40 points after I took the course. And again, the review course is a very high level review course, really helpful for tons of people. Again, I've had tons of people take each of these courses and they've done really well on the exams. And then if you're looking ahead to Step 2 CK, Step 3 in the summer, now that the March cycle is effectively over, I have a 40% Step 2 CK / Step 3 school. Obviously, it's going to apply to people taking Complex Level 2 or 3 as well. It's going to be taking place from May 2nd to May 13th, 2022. The course is, you know, it's 75 hours long, but it's going to be like a big time review. I literally made a podcast specifically on that. I will encourage you to check that podcast out. But what I will say is, it's going to be a 40% cap, because again, I want to really invest deeply in everyone that's attending. But if you attend it, you're not going to have a bad time. You're going to have a wonderful time. You're going to learn a lot in many different ways, in many different dimensions. The goal of that course is to prepare you like extremely well for Step 2 CK or Step 3 or Complex Level 2 or 3. Okay, so let's just jump right into it. So if you're interested in any of these things, just shoot me an email through the website and I'll give you some more information on cost, on how to register and things like that. So what if they give you a question about a 55-year-old guy? They tell you that for the last 3 days, he has been having pain in his thumb, right? And then you notice that you see some vesicular lesions under his, like around his nail fold on his right thumb. And then they say, what's your next best step in management? Well, I would really hope that your next best step in management is to go ahead and give the person acyclovir, right? Oral acyclovir, right? So this person obviously has herpetic Whitlow. Herpetic Whitlow is treated with oral acyclovir. They may try to trick you on the exam into giving IV acyclovir. You don't give IV acyclovir for herpetic Whitlow, right? Again, one concept, I guess, that is high yield to understand for exams is when you give oral versus IV therapy. It's not everybody that gets IV therapy. Usually, people that get IV therapy are people that fall into two categories. One, people that have very severe illness, right? They're like hemodynamically unstable, or, you know, they are super febrile, or they have like a powerful leukocytosis and organ damage. And then the second group of people that get IV therapy are people that cannot tolerate oral intake. To be honest with you, those are really the only two people that should ever get IV therapy on MBME exams. If you're giving IV therapy to people that should be getting oral therapy, in fact, the MBMEs, they do this from time to time, where they'll put the same answer, they'll put the oral formulation of the drug, and then they'll put the IV formulation of the drug, right? Again, you need to keep some of these principles in mind as you make these judgment calls on exams, right? So we know that, obviously, right, herpetic Whitlow is caused by the herpes virus, right? Remember, the herpes virus causes many different problems, right? So it can cause, the genital infection, right? Which, again, is also treated with acyclovir, right? But it can also cause the oral infection, right? Herpes labialis, right? And again, both of these things can be treated with acyclovir, right? And many of these things tend to be reactivations of disease, right? Now, remember that herpes can also cause meningitis, right? Typically, remember, if herpes wants to torch a person's brain, it's going to go after the temporal lobes, right? And many times those people are going to have hemorrhagic lumbar punctures, right? So you check the CSF and you're going to be seeing like hundreds, sometimes thousands of red blood cells, right? Yes, you can have that in a subarachnoid hemorrhage, right? But you can also certainly have that in a person that has like herpes meningitis, right? So Remember, just keep those things in mind with herpes for your exam, right? So how does acyclovir work? Well, remember, acyclovir is a DNA polymerase inhibitor. Now, I want to explain something to you here. The NBMEs, they love to do this thing where, again, and this is something I emphasize heavily in my test taking strategies class and in my review courses, that the NBMEs these days, the answers you're expecting to the questions you read are not the answers you're going to see on your exam. The thing the NBMEs love to do is, again, they're just trying to push things a step further. They're trying to see people that are actually studying, people that actually understand things instead of just blindly memorizing things. So again, they put these things I call derivative answers on exams, where it's something you know, but you just put it in different terms. So that's something you want to be mindful of as you study for your exam, right? So like, for example, instead of putting acyclovir as an answer, they can put, if they want to make it an easier answer, well, let me not say an easier answer, a slightly harder answer will be a DNA polymerase inhibitor. But one thing that the NBMEs love to do these days is that they love to instead use this term, right? So, because let me explain first. Instead of putting DNA polymerase inhibitor, they would rather put the answer that says inhibitor of a DNA-dependent DNA polymerase, right? So you may be like, Divine, are those not different terms, DNA polymerase inhibitor versus inhibitor of a DNA-dependent DNA polymerase? No, they're the same term, right? Because what does DNA polymerase do? DNA polymerase uses DNA as a template, and then its output is DNA. So it's a DNA. So DNA polymerase itself is DNA dependent, right? So it's dependent on the template. It's DNA dependent. And then it makes DNA. It's a DNA polymerase, right? Acyclovir and ganciclovir. Remember, ganciclovir is not for herpes. It's more for CMV. Although CMV is one of the herpes viruses, right? So, but ganciclovir is also a DNA polymerase inhibitor. It inhibits a DNA-dependent DNA polymerase. Okay. But now, let's maybe try something else. What if we look at the HIV drugs, right, that are NRTIs or NNRTIs, right? Remember, NRTI means nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitor. NNRTI means, you know, non-nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitor. Well, let's ask ourselves, what in the world does reverse transcriptase mean? Or what in the world does reverse transcriptase do? Well, remember, reverse transcriptase is an enzyme, right? Because remember, transcription is when you go from DNA to RNA. So reverse transcription is when you're going from RNA to DNA, right? So that means reverse transcriptase uses an RNA template to produce DNA, right? It's that DNA of HIV that then integrates into the genome, right? And that's usually done by the integrase enzyme, right? So if you think about it, since reverse transcriptase uses RNA as a template and makes DNA as its output, on an NBME exam, they can give you a HIV question. And instead of saying, oh, administer a reverse transcriptase inhibitor, they can put in the answer that says inhibitor of an RNA-dependent DNA polymerase, right? I'll say that again, inhibitor of an RNA-dependent DNA polymerase, because it depends on RNA as the template, but it produces DNA as its output, right? Another classic question they can write in this vein is they can give you a question about a person that has TB, right? And then they tell you that, well, the person is having these orange secretions, these red secretions, red tears, urine, earwax, right? And then they say, which of the following agents is most likely responsible for the following side effects? Well, remember that the agent that is responsible is rifampin. But again, instead of putting rifampin, one smart thing our friends at the NBMEs can do is that they will write RNA polymerase inhibitor. Okay, well, if they want to make the question a little more challenging, they will put DNA-dependent RNA polymerase inhibitor, an inhibitor of DNA-dependent RNA polymerase activity, right? Because again, an RNA polymerase uses DNA as its template, and then it produces RNA as its output, right? So whenever you see a drug that is a DNA polymerase inhibitor, or an RNA polymerase inhibitor, or a reverse transcriptase inhibitor, I will encourage you to try to just think through and be able to express it in this XYZ dependent XYZ polymerase template that I'm explaining to you right now. I know you may be like, wow, Divine, You're spending an inordinate amount of time on this, but this stuff is extremely high yield for the test, right? Now, what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that the patient, you know, was admitted to the hospital a few weeks ago for an infection, for a kidney infection, and then they took an antibiotic. But then now, you know, a few weeks later, they have to crank up their televisions all the way up to be able to hear a thing. What antibiotic did those people take? But I would really hope you're saying, Divine, this person likely took gentamicin, right? Likely took an aminoglycoside, right? So I know some of you may be like, wow, Divine, yes, I get it. Gentamicin, you know, the aminoglycosides, they are ototoxic. But why didn't you pick vancomycin as your answer? In fact, let me tell you this. Our friends at the MBMEs, right? The smart thing that they would do, to be honest with you, any smart question writer will put vancomycin as an answer. Because vancomycin is also ototoxic, right? And some of you may be like, wow, Divine, that's very evil of you. How can you be suggesting that we put vanc as an answer and we put gentamicin as an answer? The thing is, whenever they give you two answers that suffice for a question, right? Many times, none of those will be right. Or there's a differentiating factor that has been placed in the question that will help you pick one from the other, right? So there is a differentiating factor in this vignette that I gave you that I would hope will make you not pick vancomycin and make you pick more an aminoglycoside. Because think about it. I said that the person had an infection, right? If I missed it, my apologies, but let's say they had a kidney infection, right? Kidney infections are caused almost exclusively by gram-negative organisms, right? Don't get me wrong, you know, staph saprophyticus, gram-positive can cause some issues. But for the most part, right, you're looking at E. coli, things like that. Well, if you want to cover gram-negatives, you're going to be using an aminoglycoside, right? You're going to be using vancomycin to cover gram-negatives. Vancomycin almost exclusively covers only gram-positive infections, right? So if it was a kidney infection or a UTI of some sort, you want to pick the aminoglycosides. Remember, the aminoglycosides are nephrotoxic, right? But they are also ototoxic, right? Now, don't forget that the aminoglycosides also cause neuromuscular blockade, right? They essentially work as nicotinic receptor blockers. They impede the activity of the nicotinic receptor. So since they have like a built-in neuromuscular blockade, may not be the most genius idea in the world to hand over these drugs to people that have neuromuscular diseases, right? So people that have ALS, for example, or people that have myasthenia gravis, for example, right? Or people that have like polyodermatomyositis, or people that have like Lambert-Eaton myasthenic syndrome. Giving those people aminoglycosides is not a smart idea at all, right? So aminoglycosides, again, they have that cluster of nephrotoxicity, but they're also ototoxic. Now, I also want to draw your attention to vancomycin. Vancomycin is also nephrotoxic and ototoxic, right? And don't forget, there are other drugs that have that symptom cluster of nephro and ototoxicity. Your loop diuretics, especially ethocrinic acid, is also nephrotoxic and ototoxic. And then the anti-cancer drug cisplatin is also nephrotoxic and ototoxic, right? It's also nephrotoxic and ototoxic. So some of you may wonder, why does this cluster almost always seem to exist together? That, oh, if a drug damages your hearing, it also could potentially damage your kidneys. The thing is, there are many transporters that we find in the kidneys that we also find in the inner ear. Those transporters work almost identically to each other, right? So if one drug can nuke your kidneys, you better believe that it could potentially nuke the person's ears, right? Yes, there may be slight variations, but they are very closely related. So most drugs that are ototoxic, to be honest with you, end up also being nephrotoxic. Now, what if they give you a question about a person that has HIV, right? And, you know, their CD4 count, they were just newly diagnosed, their CD4 count was like 50. And then they tell you that they were started on highly active antiretroviral therapy. And then they were also started on appropriate prophylactic measures. And then weeks later, you notice that these people's potassium is really high. Well, what's going on there? Well, I really hope you're saying, Divine, this person has problems with trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole, right? So why is this person's potassium really high? Because of trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole. Well, don't forget, trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole is, It's a folate synthesis inhibitor, right? We use it to prophylax against toxoplasmosis when your CD4 count goes below 100, and pneumocystis jervetii when your CD4 count goes below 200, right? Now, these drugs are folate synthesis inhibitors, right? So, like, if you look at it, TMPSMX, trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole, right? The sulfamethoxazole, you know, inhibits an enzyme called dihydroptherate synthesis, right? It basically competes with an agent called PABA for dihydroptherate synthesis, right? So, but once dihydroptherate synthesis binds it, it cannot work on PABA. It's almost like you're taking up the spot that should be taken up by PABA. PABA means para-aminobenzoic acid, right? And then the trimethoprim part of TMPSMX inhibits dihydrofolate reductase. So you don't convert dihydrofolate to tetrahydrofolate, right? And when you have tetrahydrofolate, when you don't have tetrahydrofolate, you're going to have a lot of major problems with synthesizing a DNA, right? And you're also going to have problems with like B12 and all that metabolism, right? Methionine and all those things, right? But that's not the point of this podcast, right? So the thing is, these drugs, right, TMPSMX works in this way, right? So because it inhibits folate synthesis, it can actually cause a person to have bone marrow suppression, right? But why do these people have hyperkalemia? Well, if you think back to the principal cell of the nephron, remember that the principal cell of the nephron has an Enoch channel, right? That Enoch channel is on the urine side. It's on the apical surface. It brings in sodium. And as sodium is coming into the principal cell, right, you are literally depleting the extracellular environment of the principal cell of positive charges. So you're going to build up a series of negative charges. That series of negative charges, or those negative charges, right? Let me be grammatically correct here. Those negative charges that you're building up, right, is going to start ripping potassium ions out of the principal cell. And that makes sense. Remember, potassium is primarily an intracellular ion. So there's a ton of it inside the principal cell, okay? So normally, just by gradient energy, right? Because again, there's more potassium inside the cell than outside the cell. Potassium will flow down its gradient to the outside of a cell. But you're essentially augmenting that potassium gradient by this buildup of negative charge on the outside. It's almost like you're creating an electrostatic gradient as well that will draw potassiums out, right? So that Enoch channel, as more sodium is reabsorbed, you create those negative charges, and then you draw potassium from the cell, right? So the thing is, trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole actually works like a potassium-sparing diuretic. It blocks those Enoch channels. So think about, if you block those Enoch channels, then you never end up creating those, or you, on a much reduced magnitude, end up creating almost no negative charges in the extracellular environment of the principal cell. So that means you have all these positive charges there that are not supposed to be there. So those positive charges, if you can imagine it, they would potentially repel a person. Though, because those potassium ions that are trying to come out of the cell, when they see all these positive charges, they're almost like repelled back. They're like, go back to where you came from. Don't come out here, right? So they are repelled. So those potassium ions that are not being excreted, right, with your urine, they're going to build up in your body. So you're going to get hyperkalemia. Hyperkalemia is a time-honored side effect of trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole. Now, the thing is, since I guess we're on the topic of trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole, they can also give you a question about a person that takes TMPSMX, right? And then they tell you that the person, you know, starts becoming fatigued, starts having shortness of breath. And then they show you that this person has they develop jaundice. And they have an indirect hyperbilirubinemia. Well, what in the world happened there? Well, I hope you're saying that, Divine, the stuff that happened there is this person has G6PD deficiency, right? G6PD, right, is, again, glucose-6-phosphate dehydrogenase. Now, G6PD, is an X-linked recessive disease, right? So it shouldn't be showing up in ladies on the exams, right? It should be a male-only question. I would hope you kind of latch onto that. But, you know, in addition to just showing up in guys, right? Remember, in G6PD deficiency, glucose-6-phosphate dehydrogenase doesn't work. So you're going to have a lot of problems with generating NADPH, right? You're going to have a lot of problems with generating NADPH. And, you know, you need NADPH to deal with reactive oxygen species in your body. So when you're taking a drug that's a powerful oxidizing agent, right? Like these sulfur drugs. Remember, sulfur, if you remember from, you know, general chemistry in college, is in group 6 of the periodic table like oxygen. It's a very powerful oxidizing agent. So it can cause oxidative stress, right? So that oxidative stress, if you are not able to make any DPH, you cannot do that glutathione system properly, right? So you're going to be kind of being in trouble there, right? So that's why sometimes before people are started, especially these African Americans or people from like susceptible populations like Greek, Mediterranean populations, it's not always done, but a prudent physician should probably order G6PD assays in these people, right? So remember, G6PD deficiency, right? Because you cannot deal with oxidative stress, that damages the red blood cell. As that red blood cell explodes, right, you're gonna have a lot of hemolysis, right? You're gonna have indirect hyperbilirubinemia. That's why the person has those findings. And then another thing I guess I would say is that remember, these people that have G6PD deficiency, right, they're going to have Heinz bodies on a blood smear, and they're also going to have bite cells, right? So again, think of G6PD deficiency being problematic when you eat things like fava beans that are powerful oxidants, right? Or when you take things that are powerful oxidizing agents, like those are like nitrates, right? So they can give you a person, you know, that is taking nitrates for something, right? Like nitrates, nitroprusside, right? Those drugs are very powerful oxidizing agents, right? So just be careful of those things in people that have G6PD deficiency, or even primaquine, right? Primaquine. Many people that have, like populations that have G6PD deficiency can also have malaria in those populations, right? So you can already be getting to see the NBME concoct this malaria question. Person took primaquine and then boom, they have all these findings, right? Again, think of glucose 6-phosphate dehydrogenase deficiency. Right. And again, people that have G6PD deficiency, whether you like it or not, these people are susceptible to infections, right? Especially infections that are cleared by neutrophils. Because the thing is, again, NADPH is very necessary for, surprise, surprise, NADPH oxidase to work, right? So if you have an NADPH deficiency, you don't have enough coenzyme for NADPH oxidase to work, right? So your reactive oxygen burst is going to be okay, but it's not going to be as good, right? It's not going to be as good. So notice I didn't say, oh, catalyst positive organisms. But again, if NADPH oxidase doesn't work, you're just going to have problems, right? You're going to have problems. But the reason why these people don't have like overwhelming streams of infections like people with chronic granulomatous disease is that even if glucose 6-phosphate dehydrogenase doesn't work to produce NADPH, there are other enzymes in the body that can make NADPH, right? Like, if I'm not mistaken, there's an enzyme known as malic enzyme. It's like, again, we're not going to go deep into biochemistry today, but I believe it's called the NADP-dependent malic enzyme. I think malic enzyme converts NADP plus to NADPH, right? So that's like an alternate pathway that can help. So since we've gone on for almost 23 minutes, I'm going to go ahead and pause here. Again, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLE exams, step 1, step 2 CK, step 3. Preclinical med school exams, third year clerkship exams. I also offer tutoring for the internal medicine in-training exam and the board exam. So if you're interested in any of those things, just shoot me an email. Again, I've worked with thousands of people in my life. Again, a vast majority of the people I've worked with have done extremely well on the exams. At least my podcasts should give you a good indication of how I teach. And for those that are attending the webinar tonight, the webinar will give you a very good indication of what my courses look like. We're going to be going for just an hour in the webinar, right? But my courses are 24 hours long. My school is 75 hours long. So you can imagine times 24 or times 75 of what you see today, right? That will give you again an idea of how well put together the courses are. And then I do have these podcasts on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts, on Spotify, at least the most recent 150, right? So the 230 or so podcasts that you don't see there, again, it's a rule. It's nothing, I can't really circumvent it. So if you want everything from episode 1 all the way to episode 380, just go on the website, divineinterventionpodcasts.com. If you subscribe to the website with your WordPress account, you'll actually get an email notification whenever I make a new podcast. And then I have a YouTube channel called Divine Intervention USMLE Podcasts and Videos. That's where I post the videos that I make. And then I also help with ERAS applications. I know literally like the day the match ends is the day the next ERAS cycle starts in my book. I've already started working with people for their ERAS applications for the 2022-2023 cycle. So if you're interested in any of those things, shoot me an email and I'll give you some more information. So thank you for listening to me today. Have a wonderful rest of your day. Have a wonderful weekend. God bless you. I'll see you in episode 381.